Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 5th, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, decoding the images we see when we dream, more evidence for mantle plumes, and how close are we to bringing species back from extinction?
I think trying to recreate anything perfectly is an illusion. Trying to recreate it pretty well, I think we can do. Whether pretty well is enough to make it worthwhile is a value question that everyone will have to answer for themselves.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
The internet has recently been abuzz about de-extinction, the process by which extinct species are literally brought back to life. Though scientists can't boast of any successful de-extinctions just yet, the technology is close at hand. But just because we can revive a species, should we? Henry Greeley and Jacob Chertoff expound upon the ethical, political, and scientific implications of such endeavors in a policy forum this week. I spoke with Greeley about his paper and began by asking him how a species could be brought back to life in the first place.
There are three main techniques that are being talked of and in some cases used. The first is backbreeding. If you've got a species that's extinct, but the genes from it, the genetic variations from it, still exist among its successor species, you might be able to take individuals from those successor species, breed them together in a way to select those old gene variants, and ultimately recreate the initial extinct species. That's got some limitations, though. You need a species that has left its genes in its descendants. The dodo doesn't have any descendants. The passenger pigeon doesn't really have any descendants. So it's not going to be of widespread value, I think. A second method is cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer. This one can work. In fact, it already has worked for about 10 minutes. There's an extinct species of mountain goat, the Pyrenean ibex. The last member of the species died in 2000. When she died, the scientists had previously taken tissue samples from her, treated them, and frozen them. 3 years later, in 2003, they thawed out some of those frozen cells, made hundreds of embryos. They got one pregnancy, which led to one kid, which unfortunately was born with a third non-functional lung, which caused it to die after 7 minutes. The problem with cloning is you need good viable cells, or at least good viable cell nuclei, in order to do it. Most extinct species, we don't have nice, carefully frozen cells. And even cells that were frozen in permafrost probably aren't going to be viable enough to use for this technique. The last and I think most wide-ranging technique is the one that isn't ready for prime time yet, but we're getting closer to it, and that's genetic editing. If we know the DNA sequence of the extinct animal, and there is living an animal that is relatively closely related to the extinct animal, so let's say a passenger pigeon, extinct, bandtail pigeon, alive. We can compare the gene sequences of both those animals, look at where the passenger pigeon differed from the bandtail pigeon, and then start a stem cell line from the bandtail pigeon, start making inserted genetic changes in the DNA sequence to make its sequence more similar to the passenger pigeon sequence. Right now, it would take a long time and a lot of money, but the technologies for targeted insertions are moving ahead very, very quickly. And I think in the next 5 or 10 years, this is going to be a viable strategy. So those are the three main methods: backbreeding, cloning, and genetic editing.
And even if we should hone any of these techniques, are they likely to ever be successful on a predictable, consistent scale? As you point out in your paper, there are some much more subtle factors that play a role in an organism's survival in addition to just the DNA.
So I think there are two questions there. One is, what's the likelihood they'll succeed in producing an animal or individuals that look like they're from the extinct species? I think it's likely we can bring back individuals with the genomes or genomes similar to those of a lot of these species. The deeper question is, will they really be from the same species? We have no reason to believe they will have the same epigenetic markers on their genome. They won't have the same microbiome. They won't have the same gut bacteria and other microorganisms living with them, which we are increasingly understanding play important roles in the lives of modern species, including Homo sapiens. They won't have the same environment. Even if you put them in the same place, that place has changed. Mm-hmm. Other species have changed. The CO2 content in the atmosphere has changed. And finally, and this will sound a little odd, we won't be able to provide the animals with their appropriate culture. If a woolly mammoth is raised by an Asian elephant mother that doesn't do the same things woolly mammoths do, will it be a woolly mammoth?
Hmm.
So I think trying to recreate anything perfectly is an illusion. Trying to recreate it pretty well, I think we can do. Whether pretty well is enough to make it worthwhile is a value question that everyone will have to answer for themselves.
Okay, so I can already see a lot of objections that might be raised to some of these techniques. What are some of the objections that you see being raised against this field of research?
The first concern is animal welfare. And the cloning procedure in particular is not particularly safe and efficient, better for some animals than for others. I think that the animal welfare issues need to be looked at, just as they are with laboratory animals today in most labs in the United States under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. Second issue is health. These animals, if released into the wild, might be good vectors for disease.
Mm-hmm.
They might actually even have retroviruses in their DNA that somehow would get revived and end up passing on into other species. The odds of those things seem very low, but it's really hard to quantify just how low they are. The third issue, I think, is one of the bigger issues. That's the environmental consequences. The revived species could be invasive species. That seems a little odd because you're putting them back in the place they came from.
Mm-hmm.
But the place they came from isn't there anymore. The environment has changed. Fourth objection, for me a very important one, is political. The conservation biology movement has relied heavily on the argument that extinction is forever. Well, that gets trickier if you could bring it back. And I can certainly imagine some developers saying, look, we'll pay $10 million to preserve specimens of this endangered species. Now let us build our golf course.
And then, as you argue, there are actually quite a few benefits to be had from de-extinction. So tell me about those.
Sure. I think one of them is scientific knowledge. We will learn what a woolly mammoth looks like, acts like, moves like, how it actually worked. It's not perfect, but I think we still will be able to learn a lot scientifically, both about the species themselves and maybe something about how evolution works over time by comparing those species with current living species. Second potential advantage is, kind of ironically, to the environment itself. In some cases, bringing back a particular species might improve an environment. We have a contemporary example of that. In Yellowstone, wolves became locally extinct. When they were reintroduced, they've turned out to transform Yellowstone's ecosystem, to cut down on the number of elk and other big herbivores, which in turn has effects on what kind of trees and plants grow along the riverbanks, which in turn has affected erosion and has also affected an increase in songbirds. There's a third argument that I find attractive, although I'm not sure I believe it. It's the argument from justice. In many cases, we know why these animals were extinct. We killed them. Do we have some sort of duty and justice to bring back what we wantonly killed off? To me, the last advantage is a sense of wonder. I think looking at a living woolly mammoth, or for me, even better, a saber-toothed cat, would just be the most awesome thing. So I think that has to be counted on the plus side of the ledger for de-extinction.
So where does this leave us? What are the next steps for this field of research and these researchers who are going to carry on with it?
Well, I think there are two big principles to guide the future of de-extinction. One is anybody who does it should do it carefully, prudently, wisely, step by step. Don't make a huge flock of passenger pigeons and just blindly release them into the wild. But I think the second issue is more a political issue. People in governments will ultimately need to decide whether they want this to go forward and how. We don't have any regulatory scheme in the United States, at least, that fits this topic very well. We worry about endangered species, but there's no Extinct Species Act. There hasn't been a need for one. We worry a little bit about the regulation of genetically modified organisms in a very odd patchwork way, but that's mainly about crops and food. And if you're releasing something that's not intended for crops or food, it's not clear that it falls within anybody's jurisdiction. Now, one interesting side question that's particularly relevant right now when the U.S. Supreme Court is considering questions of gene patenting, could somebody patent an extinct species? It's not entirely clear, one way or the other. And it's not clear whether we should care or not, but it throws another interesting twist into the whole issue of de-extinction. So it may be that countries decide the appropriate regime is to ban it all. I personally think that would be a mistake, but more appropriate, I think, would be a decision for some limited regulatory scheme involving animal welfare protection and environmental protection, and mandating some care and thought before releases of revived species into the wild took place.
All right. Well, Hank Greeley, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Henry Greeley and Jacob Shirkoff write about de-extinction in a policy forum in this week's issue. Hey, everybody. Our show is sponsored by Audible.com, and I just wanted to remind you about a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And of course, as you have in the past, we're going to make a few recommendations. This week, I picked a book that I would really like to read, so I can't say it's a favorite. But it's also by a science news contributor. 1491 New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus by Charles Seaman. I've gotten a lot of people telling me to read that book. What did you pick, Carrie?
Well, Sarah, I was pretty excited but not exactly surprised to find that Audible carries one of my favorite books of all time, Contact by Carl Sagan. A few different versions are available, one of which is narrated by Jodie Foster, who also starred in the movie.
So, podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. When we perceive something, the sun, the sky, the ground beneath our feet, our sensory apparatus is activated. These sensors send messages up to the brain. The brain compiles these inputs and forms a pattern that seems to us like we are seeing or feeling the world outside ourselves. These same sensations are also available to us in dreams without the inputs. So, are our brains acting as if we are getting the inputs, or are special "I am dreaming" patterns at work? In a step towards answering this question, Yuki Kamitani and colleagues used fMRI to capture signature patterns associated with the visual experience of dreams. Kamitani spoke with me about the group's findings from his office in Japan.
In this study, we tried to read out or decode visual contents of dreaming from human brain activity during sleep, which is measured by functional MRI. So dreaming often accompanies vivid visual experience, and we assumed that visual contents are represented at least partly by common brain activity patterns between dreaming and perception during wakefulness. So by using content-specific activity patterns associated with stimulus perception, we were able to reveal dream contents from brain activity data during sleep.
Okay, so your study looked at the question, do our brains behave the same way when we see something while awake as they do when we have a visual experience while asleep? Can you walk us through how you looked into this? Let's start with your sleeping subjects.
Okay, we measured brain activity using fMRI from sleeping subjects while monitoring sleep stages with EEG. So we awakened the subject a few minutes after sleep onset when we detected an EEG signature that was often associated with visual dreaming. Upon awakening, the subject verbally reported what they saw and then went to sleep again. We repeated this procedure to obtain at least 200 visual reports from each subject.
So did you wake up the same person 200 times?
Yes, over many days, yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't all in one session.
Yeah.
So once you captured all this visual experience, you woke people up, you asked them what they saw right as they were dozing off. Once you got all that information out of them, what did you do with that?
Okay, so since verbal reports were not well structured, just in a free format, so we performed text analysis on the reports using a lexical database. We first extracted words depicting visual objects or scenes, and then grouped them into about 20 basic visual categories, mm-hmm. such as male, female, car, book, so based on semantic similarity. And each verbal report can now be represented by a vector with elements indicating the presence or absence of each visual category.
So you have these categories of visual items that people saw in their dream state or in their early sleep state. You also actually worked with recordings from awake people as well. What did you measure for them?
Yes. Actually, we collected natural images from the internet depicting each of the basic visual categories and presented them to the subject while measuring functional MRI, and that was used for the training of the decoder.
So then you took an awake set of awake people, presented them with similar images or images with the same semantic content.
Yes.
And then you used a decoder. What is a decoder?
Okay, using the image stimulus-induced brain activity data as a training data set, we built a machine learning model that predicts visual contents given a measured brain activity, which we call a decoder. So the machine learning algorithm can identify fine-scale, pixel-by-pixel brain image signatures relevant to the visual content.
And so with these decoders, what were you able to pick out? What patterns did you see?
Actually, the identified patterns detected by the decoder, it's very complicated, and it's very difficult to interpret each pattern itself. But when the decoder trained on the image-induced data was applied to sleep data, the outputs were largely consistent with the dream contents. So this indicates that brain activity patterns are similar between when we perceive something and when we dream, if the content is the same.
So you were able to find that the same pattern existed in the brain of a person looking at an object and then when they dream about that object. But does this same pattern hold for different people or is it just within the same person?
Not common across people, pixel by pixel.
Right.
Because the brain structure is different from person to person. But when we examined individual areas in the visual cortex, we found that each area was good at decoding a specific type of contents characterized by some semantic similarity. So there seemed to be a broad semantic specialization in each area, which is consistent across subjects.
So were you able to close the loop? So you studied the person while they're sleeping and you took data there, then you looked at wake people, presented the visual stimuli, took data there. So at the end, were you able to go to another group of sleeping people and say what they were dreaming about by looking at the readout?
Right, yeah. In future, yeah, it may be possible. Right now, we are doing just offline analysis.
Okay, well, let's talk about what the implications of this study are. Why is it important to understand the relationship between awake and sleep patterns in the brain?
Okay. The function of dreaming or more generally in spontaneous brain activity is largely unknown. If we can relate it to our waking experience, it may lead to a better understanding of the function in terms of our waking experience. Dreaming is a subjective experience and we quickly forget the contents after awakening. But our method using brain activity data associated with stimulus perception could provide unambiguous interpretations about spontaneous neural activity.
Well, Yuki Kamatani, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Yuki Kamatani and colleagues write about decoding dreams online this week. You can read their Science Express report at www.scienceexpress.org, and you can find a related news article in this week's issue.
When the theory of plate tectonics came along in the 1960s, it answered many long-standing questions about the Earth, like why so many volcanoes are concentrated around the so-called Ring of Fire in the Pacific Ocean Basin. Phenomena that fall outside the mold, like hotspots and volcanoes in the interiors of continents, were tentatively attributed to mantle plumes, fountains of molten rock that rise up from the deep mantle, independently of the tectonic processes happening at the surface. Without clear seismic evidence, researchers have long debated whether or not mantle plumes exist, but that might be changing. Science news writer Richard Kerr spoke with me about what we've been learning about the deep Earth.
The Earth's rocky mantle is a heat engine. It's 2,900 kilometers deep, all rock, and it carries heat toward the surface, returns cold rock to the depths. And scientists think they have a little better handle on how this machine works now, since they are accepting the fact that there are giant plumes of hot rock rising from the depths. They feed volcanic centers like Hawaii, but they also form part of this heat engine.
And Earth science has certainly come really quite a far way in the last half a century. Plate tectonics came along, and we've encountered really a lot of advances in seismology and tomography. So why has it been so difficult to prove or disprove the existence of mantle plumes?
Well, ideally, you like to see them. That's difficult when you've got all that rock between you and the plume. So seismologists have been probing Earth's mantle for decades. You set up a lot of seismometers, look at how seismic waves from distant earthquakes arrive at different locations, crank it all into what's called a tomographic analysis, the way doctors create an image of your interior from a CT scan. And they can see things in the mantle, but plumes have proven to be very elusive. They're just tough things to image seismically.
Now, in your article, you discuss two recent research papers that may actually be putting an end to this discussion, this debate. So tell me about those.
Well, these are two different approaches to pinning down the existence of plumes. In one, scientists ran the plate tectonics machine backwards in time. They took the surface rock back to where it was relative to the deep interior when some feature formed, some feature that you could expect to be related to plumes. These are hotspots, something called kimberlite pipes. That's where diamonds have been blasted to the surface from the deep mantle. And also location of humongous volcanic eruptions in the distant past. And lo and behold, all these types of presumably plume-related phenomena were occurring over or especially around the edges of two deep mantle features that seismologists have been able to image for many years. Various names for these structures, but piles will suffice. These are two large piles of something different sitting on the bottom of the mantle up against the molten core that's at the center of everything. And these are on opposite sides of the planet, one under Africa, one under the South Pacific. And they're deep. They're down almost 3,000 kilometers. And if you've got these surface features that are forming over these extremely deep features, you figure there's something connecting them, and plumes are the natural thing to connect them.
So the plumes that we see at the surface may not actually be originating anywhere at the core mantle boundary. They may be confined to these two specific areas.
Right, and it makes sense to the scientists who do computer models of how the Earth's interior should behave as it churns and carries the heat around.
And then there's a second paper in which the researchers claim to actually be able to visualize the mantle plume lying below Yellowstone.
Yes, and seismologists have been rather argumentative about whether anybody has ever imaged a mantle plume seismically. But in this one case where everything seems to have been working in the favor of the seismologists, they do seem to have imaged a deep mantle plume. This comes under Yellowstone, one of the major hotspots
big one
of the world. And seismologists had a couple things working in their favor. One was more data than anybody's ever had. This was courtesy of something called the Transportable Array. This is a network of seismometers, very closely spaced, but the network spanned from the Canadian border to the Mexican border. They were able to see this warmer than normal column of rock rise up from the depths and pass through what had been considered an impenetrable boundary between the lower mantle and the upper mantle. This hasn't gotten around much. It's been published, but seismologists are only just now becoming aware of the power of this new data set. And it seems to be persuading even seismologists who had been skeptical of mantle plume imaging.
Okay, so say that mantle plumes really are happening and that they're originating in these two piles, so to speak, at the core mantle boundary. I mean, what exactly is happening down there? You know, how do these piles form? How is material rising from them? How is this engine all working?
Well, scientists now have two major parts to the mantle heat engine. The plumes, there's probably a couple dozen rising from the bottom of the mantle to the surface, carrying heat and triggering all sorts of things. Hotspot volcanism like Hawaii, these humongous volcanic eruptions that may have triggered mass extinctions. In the other direction, they've long known that massive chunks of ocean tectonic plate has been diving back into the mantle.
Right.
That's cold. That's the return flow. And some of these apparently reach the very bottom of the mantle, which is where much of the mystery remains. There are these two piles, which scientists are not at all sure about what they're made out of, how they got there. There are also smaller, more restricted layers at the bottom of the mantle that might be partially molten mantle. They might be iron-rich crud picked up from the core. Exactly how all this got going is not entirely clear. There has been some modeling by researchers who basically model the heat engine and simulate where hot rock, where cold rock is going to go. And one interesting outcome of this modeling is that the slabs of cold tectonic plate going down could be hurting the various kinds of crud that seem to be on the bottom of the mantle into these two piles. So the piles may be general mantle detritus that has been swept up into these two piles. They seem to have been there for at least a few hundred million years. So there's obviously now strong connections between the bottom of the mantle and what's going on at the surface. How those newly recognized parts work to make that connection is still under discussion.
All right. Well, Richard Kerr, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Richard Kerr writes about mantle plumes and the Earth's heat engine in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story about a new tool for fighting the very last stages of cancer.
That's right, Sarah. One of the big problems with cancer is metastasis. That's when a cell breaks off from another group of cancerous cells, travels into the bloodstream, lodges itself somewhere else, and forms a new tumor there. The problem is that when these cells start breaking off, they're at very low concentrations in the bloodstream. There can be only as little as one cancer cell per billion blood cells. So they're very hard to detect. And obviously, doctors want to detect these cells as soon as possible so they can start treatment if these cells are starting to travel around the body.
So what does this new tool bring to the arsenal in fighting cancer?
Well, this new tool is something called a CTCI chip. The CTC stands for circulating tumor cells, which are these cells that are flowing throughout the body. And the eye chip is a silicon chip, and actually in this method, it's actually two silicon chips that are the size of microscope slides, and they're etched with these really tiny channels that are no wider than a human hair. And what happens is the researchers can take a sample of blood and put it on this chip. And what the chip does is it, first of all, it binds to proteins that are common on red blood cells and platelets, and it keeps these cells stuck to the chip. And that only lets the cancer cells and white blood cells flow past. And then what this second chip does is it basically has these magnetic beads which stick on to the white blood cells. And therefore, you've got this gamut that the blood sample is running through until at the end of it, all you're left with is these circulating tumor cells.
So it's a subtractive process.
Exactly.
So you take out the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and then you just have these circulating tumor cells. What can you do with them once you have them?
Well, first of all, it allows researchers to take a really large volume of blood and determine whether there are any circulating tumor cells in them. So if you wanted to do a diagnostic test, you know, is my cancer starting to metastasize? Right now, that's really hard to determine in its early stages because we're just not able to detect these really minute quantities of cancer cells in the bloodstream. This test will allow doctors to really filter out those cells if they exist. So it could lead to some earlier treatments for metastasis. Also, scientists don't understand a lot about how these cells work. And to understand how something works, you really need to study a lot of them. And this method will allow researchers to collect a large number of these circulating tumor cells, and potentially that could lead to new breakthroughs in understanding how these cells work and how they cause metastasis and cancer.
Now that they have this tool, what are the next steps for this research group?
Well, right now it's still two chips, and the researchers want to try to integrate it into one chip just to make the process simpler. And the other objective is to bring the cost down a bit so that this would be a simple and widely available test.
Okay, next up we have a story about a potential new drug for people who suffer from insomnia and why we might want to make the switch.
Well, some of the common insomnia drugs in the market, drugs that you may have heard of like Ambien and Lunesta, are very effective, but they have side effects. Because they sort of slow down the brain, they target these receptors in the brain for a neurotransmitter known as GABA, which is important for mood, cognition, and muscle tone. So by targeting GABA indiscriminately in the brain, these drugs not only help the brain slow down, but they also can impair cognition. They can cause amnesia, confusion, other problems with learning and memory. They've also been known to cause some pretty bizarre sleepwalking behavior. So there's a lot of sort of unpleasant side effects with these drugs. And this new study is trying to figure out, is there a better drug that we can develop that could help people sleep, but without all of these unwanted side effects?
So in this case, they weren't looking at GABA, though. They were looking at a different system involved with sleeping.
Yeah. So what they targeted was a system called the orexin system. And orexin, which is also known as hypocretin, is a protein that controls wakefulness. And it's missing in people with narcolepsy. And that seemed to the researchers a good system to target, especially if you're trying to help people sleep. And they developed a drug, which they called DORA-22, that inhibits orexin. And they found that it could induce sleep as effectively as GABA. They tested it in both rats and rhesus monkeys, and they found that these rodents and these primates were sleeping just as well as they had on the GABA drugs. What's more is that they didn't seem to have any of the side effects. They gave these animals tests where they had to recognize objects after a certain period of time. Would they remember the objects? The monkeys had to match colors on a touch screen and to pay attention to the identity and origin of a flashing light. So these are all a bunch of tests to figure out, you know, how well are these animals thinking? How well are they remembering? And what they found was that this drug that they developed, this DORA-22, didn't seem to have any negative impact on cognition or memory.
So maybe it's more specific to just sleep as opposed to these GABA drugs. Well, what about people? Has this been tried in people?
It hasn't been tried in people yet, and that's obviously the next step. What the researchers and the experts are excited about is, if this works in people, not only would it be an advance over current drugs because it wouldn't have the side effects, theoretically, but also the current drugs don't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of unclear why some drugs work for some people and some drugs don't work for other people. So scientists are always looking for additional drugs and drugs that target different pathways, because the idea is if these other drugs aren't working because they're targeting the same GABA pathway, maybe people that don't respond to those drugs would respond to this new drug instead.
Great. So last up, we have a story about what happens after you take a drug and use the bathroom.
Exactly. This is actually a pretty big concern. You know, we take so many pharmaceuticals that these are bound to end up in the environment. How it happens is, as you so eloquently stated, you go to the bathroom, these chemicals find their way into sewage treatment plants, the sewage gets treated, but the water ends up back in rivers and streams. And the question is, what impact is that having on those ecosystems?
And I think from the annual meeting, we did a story about the impact on animals.
Right.
So this story is taking it even further down the food chain.
This goes even deeper. This goes into the slime that sort of lives in rivers and streams. If you've ever sort of slipped on a rock when trying to cross a stream, you know what we're talking about. Basically, these are called biofilms. These are agglomerations of bacteria, algae, and fungi, other organic matter. Slime may not seem like a really important component of the ecosystem, but it's actually really important because fish, snails, insects, they all nibble on this. And without it, these animals can starve, and that could impact the entire ecosystem.
And so how do they look at the impact of drugs on slime?
Well, the researchers took some cups and they filled them with agar, and they added one kind of pharmaceutical, then covered them up with a filter, and they placed them actually in rivers, and they tried to see what the impact of these drugs were on biofilms. And the researchers tested six drugs. They tested antihistamines, caffeine, an antibiotic, an anti-diabetic medicine, and they found that all of them dampened algal growth by 4% to 22% compared to the controls that they use. What's more, the respiration of these biofilms was cut in half. And in one stream, the photosynthesis, this really important process that these biofilms need to survive, was cut by 99%.
So those are really big numbers for this being detrimental to streams. But is this the kind of concentration or dose we'd see of those drugs in the wild?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And the researchers say they don't know. An expert that we consulted for this article thinks that the researchers are probably in the ballpark, which suggests that the impacts they're seeing may not be very off the mark. But that's definitely one question for future studies, is to try to really get at what dosage is appropriate to look at the impact that it's having on these river and stream ecosystems.
Okay. Is this something that we might see regulation for if these impacts are as large as these scientists think?
Yeah. I mean, if there's a really big environmental impact, you might potentially see, at least in the United States, regulation under the Clean Water Act. So that, again, is something that needs to be further investigated.
Okay. So what else do you have on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about breath prints. It turns out each of us has a unique breath print, just like a fingerprint, and our breath could even reveal what kind of drugs we've been taking or what kind of diseases we might be developing. Also, a story about early puberty and the link between early puberty and behavioral problems later in life. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about whether Canadian scientists are being muzzled. Also a story about a Chinese researcher who's been accused of economic espionage in Wisconsin. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about Jurassic Park 20 years later. 2 decades after the Steven Spielberg movie came out, how have our conceptions of dinosaurs changed since then? And this is going to be a video chat. Oh. And we're going to have one of the world famous dinosaur experts. Jack Horner was actually a consultant on all Jurassic Park movies as one of our guests. Next week's Science Live is about genetic privacy. How much control do we have over our own DNA? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the April 5th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi, on behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS. Thanks for joining us.